The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's your girl, Titi Torres, and let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a mother, a wife, plus a 20-year multimedia executive and personality,
and your host of Tap In with Titi, the podcast,
where the culture speaks loud and clear. I'm having conversations with your favorite artists, rising stars, movers and shakers,
from the streets to the boardrooms, from healing to hustle.
New episodes every week on the Odyssey Creators Live,
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your audio.
So tap in with me, Titi.
What are you waiting for?
Hey, Art Colony listeners, the Art Colony podcast will soon mark one full year on the air. And to celebrate the occasion, we are organizing a live podcast recording, and you are invited to join us in the live studio audience. So come over Tuesday, July 21st, 2026 at 7 p.m. at the Provincetown Commons, 46 Bradford Street in Provincetown. Space is limited, so reserve your spot in advance at provincetowncommons.org. I want to extend a huge thanks to the Provincetown Commons and to the Provincetown Art Gallery Association for hosting this event for us. And all proceeds from ticket sales and donations will go to support these two organizations. See you there. Welcome to The Art Colony, a podcast about art and art history in Provincetown. My name is Gaston Lacombe.
And my name is Joe Woolley. There's a studio in Whaler's Wharf on Commercial Street in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Walk past it any day of the week and you will see paintings in the windows, hard edges, explosive with color, bold shapes that stop you in your tracks. Inside, if you're lucky, you'll find the artist himself working, talking to visitors, creating, researching. That artist has been there since 2016. He opened that gallery in 2018, and 12 months ago, he started doing something else entirely. He started asking questions and created this podcast. A love letter to Provincetown, a living historical document, The Art Colony. 50 episodes later, I'm here to ask him a few questions. In December 2025, a listener left a comment on Apple Podcasts. They wrote, "My only wish is that one day we would get to turn the tables and hear his story through the lens of someone else interviewing him." My name is Joe Woolley, and I'm a former journalist, a lover of P-Town, a fan of this podcast, and I am honored to be interviewing that person. This is episode 50 of the Art Colony podcast, and today we're turning the tables, quite literally, on that artist, that person who came up with this special show, Gaston Lacombe.
Hi, Joe.
Hi.
I'm sitting in the wrong seat today.
For those of you that aren't watching on YouTube, literally we have switched seats.
And I don't have my computer in front of me, so I'm completely disoriented.
I've got mine.
Yeah.
And I've got my notes. And as I said, I'm very excited and I'm very honored that you asked me to do this.
Well, you were the very first person to physically come to me and say, "When are we going to have a podcast about you?" So that's why the responsibility falls upon you.
Well, thank you. I take that responsibility very seriously. And again, I'm very honored and happy to be here. So it's going to be the same show, same format, same spirit, just with the chairs quite literally switched. So let's get started. Gaston, you know that the first question is, right?
Yes, I do.
As you've been starting the last 49 episodes, so who is Gaston Lacombe?
I know, right? And I should have practiced. And the reason I asked that question to everybody coming in is because I have figured you can't assume that everybody will already know who the person is. And everybody needs to do a little bit of an introduction to allow themselves to, you know, say who they are. And in my case, well, who is Gaston Lacombe? Well, I'm an artist based in Provincetown. And I'm also born and raised Canadian, but I'm also an American citizen. In the past, I have traveled and lived all over the planet. I've spent the vast majority of my adult life living outside of North America until moving to the U.S. I love cooking. I enjoy gardening. I am a great lover of art and of Provincetown.
There's so much more to you than that. But that is an excellent
intro. Well, we have
an
hour to talk about it.
We have an hour to talk about it, and I've got questions to pry information out of you if you don't give it. But I've, you know, one of the things that impressed me so much with this, you know, and you, is what a great interviewer you are. You are very prepared, and you are great at just having a conversation with that person. And that's what makes the best interviewers. Let's go back a little further. Most people who know you here and your listeners online know the Studio Lacombe story. They know about Provincetown. You've talked a bit about that. But there is a whole life before 2016 that does not come up very much. History degrees in Ottawa, 16 years in Latvia, newscasting in a language that was not your first. Let's spend more time there.
Well, yes, I was born and raised in the province of New Brunswick in Canada. New Brunswick is the only bilingual province in Canada. So my family, my education, my school, everything was completely in French. However, being in a bilingual province, English has always been part of my life. Most of my television growing up came from the state of Maine. After finishing high school at the age of 17, I went to Ottawa, the capital of Canada, for university. And that's one place where a lot of questions arise, because people are thinking, well, did you study art? Where did you get your art degree? It's like, no, I did not. Growing up where I was, it was a very rural place. And there was nothing there that was that showed that you could be a professional artist. There were no artists. There were no art galleries. There were no art classes. Art was something that was in books. Art was something that was deep in history. Art is something that did not exist physically where I was. So even though I was somebody who was drawing a lot and I was really obsessed by looking at art and learning about art, it never crossed my mind for even a quarter of a second that that could be a profession. So of course, when it came time to go to university and find something to do, I just didn't know what to do. What I really wanted to do was archaeologist. But my mother really put a big no on that. Because in her mind, you know, you went to school, you came back home. And you came back home, you found the job at home, and you lived within the family and the community. I mean, who leaves? Who does that? Which was very much the way my family functioned. So archaeologist was not something I could do at home. So I chose history because one of my neighbors was the history teacher at school, and he was friends with my parents. And I figured, well, that's sort of linked, you know, history, archaeology, something like that. And they like Mr. Richard down here, so maybe I'll do history. So yes, I did a BA and an MA in history at the University of Ottawa. I really liked it. I really loved it. But it's not something I was, you know, deeply, deeply passionate about. But it's something that I enjoyed. And it sort of put me on a track where, you know, it was inertia. Now that I've started studying history, let's keep on doing it. And I went up to the PhD level. I studied also at the University of Toronto at the PhD level. And throughout this whole time, this was the end of the 80s, in early 90s. That's when the Cold War was ending. That's when everything was happening in the ex-Soviet Union. It was on the news all the time. And the University of Ottawa had an exchange link with the University of Latvia. And that's how that happened. It was the cool thing. It was the fashionable thing at the University of Ottawa to join the Latvia Exchange Club, because you were going to go to the Soviet Union. For those who might not remember living during the Cold War, there literally was half the globe that was shuttered away. There was half the globe that was inaccessible. And that was, you know, the evil people. And all of a sudden, that half of the world opened up. And it was so thrilling to know that, you know, you could go there. So as soon as I was able to gather enough money, because you had to pay for this, and I was not a rich student in any way, I went through the Latvia Exchange Group to Latvia. I joined the group in 1991, really right after Latvia became independent. And I first traveled to Latvia in early 1992. And right away, I was completely entranced, captured, enchanted, whatever you want to use. Arriving in this place where it was a completely unknown world with people who were also completely unknown to us, different language, different culture, different everything. I remember a lot of them had never seen a color photo. You know, I had a color camera and they were so impressed and they were all so curious to learn about what happens in the West, just like we were curious to find out what happens here behind the X-Iron Curtain. And because of that, I just stayed. So 92, 93, 94, 96, I would do a bit like people do seasons in Provincetown. I would do seasons in Latvia. So I would come back to Canada to do my studies. But whenever there was any break, I'd be on a plane back to Latvia. And back then, living in Latvia was extremely cheap. I literally would leave with whatever money I had in my pocket, and I could live there as a complete emperor. It was fantastic. So going to Latvia these first few years, I worked in all sorts of odd jobs. I was an English teacher. I was a newscaster in Latvia. I was, eventually, I worked for the Minister of Defense in the NATO Integration Office. And eventually, I also moved there and stayed permanently. I kept on going back and back and back until I just stayed. And after I stayed there, I became a school teacher. And after that, I was hired by the American Embassy to run the equivalent of the Fulbright Commission in Latvia. So I did that for 8 years. And then I was hired by the Canadian Embassy to be what basically the cultural attaché. The title was Public Affairs and Public Diplomacy Officer. But my responsibilities were art, history, media, culture, education. So that was my job to represent Canada in that way in all three Baltic countries, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania. During that time also, I also became the first head of the national LGBT organization in Latvia.
Oh, wow.
There was no organized LGBT movement in Latvia.
Were you out the entire time when you were going over there?
The funny thing is yeah, I was. All through the 90s and early 2000s, being gay in Latvia really had, it meant, it was no big deal.
What about back in Canada?
Yeah, I came out in 1992, so okay. Yeah. But in Latvia, they were like, okay, well, whatever, it doesn't matter. But then American evangelists got in. Mm. And that's when everything started to really go to hell in a handbasket. That's when these ultra-radical Christian parties got into government and they started changing the constitution and they started attacking anybody who was LGBT in the public sphere. So we felt we needed to have an organization. And of course, I became the leader, which I wasn't planning on doing, but I did. But that was one of the reasons why eventually I returned to North America. Being the head of that organization put me straight in the middle of a bullseye in Latvia. I was getting regular death threats. My name was really dragged in the mud in the press. My then husband had suffered multiple situations where there was vandalism or attacks. I just could not feel safe there anymore. And my ex-husband, especially for him, he was American Latvian. So for him, it was his own people attacking him. Mm-hmm. It had a deep, deep effect on his mental health. So that's why he insisted we have to leave this country. We can't stay here anymore. I was ready to stay in Latvia forever. That's where I had settled my life. That's where my roots had been digging. But he was insistent we had to come back. He was with the World Bank, and he got a position at the DC home office at the World Bank. So that's how I ended up in the US. We ended up moving to DC. And in DC, while I was not an American citizen yet, I couldn't get a job. I didn't have a work permit. Nobody wanted to hire me because I didn't have a work permit. So I went back to school and I did a degree in photography. At that point, you know, already art was really taking over my brain. Mm. And that's what I really wanted to do. You know, when I left Latvia, a lot of my friends were saying, what are you going to do in the US? And I would joke, I'll just be like a free artist. I'll just be like a freelance artist as a joke. But really, that's what I was really dreaming about. But still in my head back then, I didn't know this was possible. But when we got to the US and I went back to school, I was thinking, well, maybe a photography degree is something that's practical, something where you have an actual job. I'll do that. So I did that. And then I spent 10 years working as a photojournalist until I discovered Provincetown.
So 16 years in Latvia and then 10 years in DC.
Yeah, 10 years in DC.
Just doing the math. Before we move on to P-Town, though, talk a little bit about the Captive Project.
You really did your research.
I did my research.
Look at that.
Just like you do with all your other guests. I've done my research.
Okay, so I did this photography degree, and my aim was to work more as a photojournalist. You know, all my life growing up, I had read all the National Geographic magazines, and I wanted to be something like that. So I was getting jobs, contracts, internships all around the world, doing a whole bunch of different jobs. And one thing I always did whenever I went to these different countries is I do tourism stuff, including visiting the zoo. And I kept on seeing these animals in zoo situations that were extremely miserable, living in deplorable conditions, not just abroad, but also here in the US and in Canada, seeing all these animals in environments that were completely unnatural and not adapted to their needs. So I started photographing them and trying to stay objective behind the camera, where I would photograph the animal in its environment and give a clear image of where this animal lived. And that became what's called the captive project. I went to dozens, if not hundreds, of zoos on 5 continents, and I photographed a lot of these animals, and that became a huge project. Mm-hmm. It was published all around the world. It was featured in a lot of big magazines. A lot of photos were, just one photo being published in this publication, that publication, all around the world. It became a really big deal, and I became associated with that for a long time.
60 plus zoos, 11 countries. Were you setting out to make a moral argument, with your camera against zoos, or did it just turn into that? Did you really have a focus and a mission to try and
It was not necessarily against, it was not against zoos. It was more about thinking about change. Another part of this project that never got published is looking at the other side of things, where I went, for example, to the San Diego Zoo multiple times to photograph the right way of doing this. Mm. But that never got published because that was less sensational, I guess. And but my idea was not necessarily saying zoos are bad, but mostly to say, in a lot of situations, zoos are inevitable, but there's a better way of doing this. And we should think about animal welfare, not just about displays. So that was really the idea behind it.
It's an incredible project. If all your listeners should go and take a look at that. So it was
when you Google Gaston Lacombe, it still comes up first page, mm-hmm. sometimes even first photo, because really that project traveled and mm-hmm. was published everywhere.
And I would argue had a major impact.
I hope so.
So we're at that part of the show where we get to Provincetown.
Mm-hmm.
You arrived in 2016, if I've done my math and my research correctly. It's a difficult moment for you. You talked about briefly your marriage. This has ended at this point. Provincetown was supposed to be a temporary place for you after that.
Well, what happened is my marriage was still not over yet, really. I had a friend in D.C. A lot of Provincetown people will know him. His name was Jim Landy. Jim has now moved to Palm Springs. But Jim was, and still is, the ultimate connector. Jim gets to know one person, and right away his brain starts thinking, who can I connect him with? So I met Jim, I don't remember, this would have been 2015 at some point. And the very first day we met, within the first hour of meeting, the guy tells me, you need to divorce and you need to move to Provincetown.
Whoa.
And I'm like, well, you don't know me. What are you saying? But he had this intuition, like, you're unhappy right now. You're deeply unhappy. You need to divorce and you need to go to Provincetown and, figure yourself out. So, yeah, my marriage was not over physically, but in my head it was. There had been a lot of issues that were detrimental to my own mental health. And we had been together 21 years. So it was hard for me to just say, okay, thank you, bye, because mm-hmm. we had built a whole life together. But for my own mental health, it was time to really go. And first thing at one point, I was in Vermont doing training I worked for National Geographic for a while as an expedition leader. And I was in Vermont doing training for the upcoming expeditions. And I was driving back to DC, and I got to the point where I hit the Mass Turnpike. And it was literally in a split second decision, I just took that exit. And I said, I'm going to go to Provincetown right now. My husband was expecting me at home that night, but I just texted him and said, hey, my training in Vermont's going to be a couple days longer. I'll see you in a few days. But I went to Provincetown and I texted Jim. I said, Jim, I'm going to Provincetown. Can I be in your house? He said, sure, here's the code.
Had you ever been here before?
Had never been to Provincetown, nothing at all. So I drove all the way to Provincetown. I was not even planning on coming here. Went to Jim's house, which is sort of behind the Puzzle Me This toy shop. Game shop, I mean. And the very first person I met that same night was Mark Luke, who's a DJ here in town. And Mark said, okay, well, you've never been here before. Let's take you out. And that night was the first Showgirls of the season. And on my first day in Provincetown, Mark Luke took me to the Atlantic House, where Showgirls was happening at that point. And I experienced that whole craziness that is Showgirls. And we recently had an episode with Ryan Landry, so you can listen back at that one and hear more about it. But that, you know, that queer effervescence, the amount of joy and freedom that existed here was something I had never seen before. And then the second day, I was like, well, let's go see some galleries. I like art. And I remember clearly the first gallery I went to was Cobalt Gallery, which is now the Greg Salvatore Gallery. Mm-hmm. And in that gallery sat Sean Robertson, who is going to show in my gallery this summer.
Oh, wow.
And Sean Robertson was also a guest on this podcast earlier on. And at that moment, it was extremely clear in my head. I said, okay, I have to leave everything. I have to drop everything. I have to move here and I have to become a full-time artist and open my own space. It was a clear vision in my head. So this was 1 month before I actually left my husband. But at that point, the plan was made in my head. This is it. I have to really drop everything and start over from scratch. So I went back home and within a few weeks, I actually did leave my husband, which was a very difficult decision to make, but I did. And then within a month after that, I was back in Provincetown and I was starting right away to make a transition. So I also met somebody here in Provincetown and fell in love, which is my current partner, Carrie Bryant. And we're still together. And that gave me a reason to come back and come back and come back. And Carrie, seeing that I was going back and forth DC Provincetown all the time, he said, well, why don't you get a studio space here? Because I had a studio space in Washington, D.C., because I was still working as a photojournalist. And I was doing all sorts of more fine artsy photo projects in studio. So Carrie inquired at the Whalers Wharf and something opened up right away. So I started in early 2018 with a studio at the Whalers Wharf that led to the gallery I have now.
Yeah, I mean, you opened Studio Lacombe 2 years after arriving. That's incredible. Less than that?
Yeah, because we got the space in February 2018 and I first came here in June 2016. Yeah.
You dove right in.
I was
P-Town waters.
I had completely deleted my life. I had left my husband. Working as a photojournalist had become extremely difficult because of the age of the iPhone, the age of the internet. As an example, I had this magazine in DC where in 2010, they hired me for a job and they said, okay, you have 3 days. We need 30 pictures. We'll pay you $800 a day and we'll pay for per diem and transport. Go. The same magazine calls me in 2015 and they have the same assignment. We need 30 pictures, but we'll give you 3 hours and we'll pay you for $100 per hour. And sorry, there's no per diem or transport. Go. So the exact same job between 2010 and 2015 went down from about $2,800 to $300. So being a photojournalist was not something that was feasible for me anymore. So yeah, I left my relationship. I left my job. And I had never chosen to live in DC. That was my husband's choice. I was like, well, DC's fun, but that was not my choice. I need to stay where I want to be now. And I moved here.
So now we're in Provincetown 9 years ago. And you start the studio. Let's talk more about your art before we move on to the podcast. The art. I think most people who listen to this show know you as the host, and they're not quite as familiar with your art because you share a little bit about it, but it's always secondary to the artist that you're talking to. You've had evolutions of your art as well. In your words, describe what your art is, mm-hmm. and then tell us about that evolution of that art.
Well, if we start from the fact that I said earlier I was born in an environment where art did not exist, it took me a very long time to figure out that this was something that real people could actually do. I had kept on drawing and doing watercolors and doing all sorts of things in the background, not showing them anywhere, and actually being very afraid to show it to anybody. I was very afraid of anybody's judgment, especially as a child, my mother, and especially when I was married of my then husband. They were both very domineering personalities, very controlling and manipulative people. And so for me to show my art to them was threatening in a certain way, but I always kept it hidden. But when I became a photojournalist, I sort of had this permission at that point. Okay, well, you can use this to create art. And although I was doing mostly assignment work, I was photographing for magazines and online outlets and stuff like that, I always had a much more artistic approach to photos, to the point where a lot of editors were a bit annoyed at me because they wanted to have, like, you know, the hard hitting blood and guts. You know, we want you to be right in the middle of the action. We want you to use drones and all these technical things. And on the other hand, I was approaching my photo as a piece of art. I was approaching it looking at color and composition and the feeling, not just trying to get in the middle of the action to see how close I could get and how much blood and guts I could get. So a lot of editors were a bit annoyed at me, but that's when I felt like, okay, well, maybe I should just continue with this artistic side of photography, because the photojournalism part is not really working anymore. So when I opened the gallery here, a lot of the work that I had in there was photography. It actually, all of it. It was photo mosaics that I had created of Provincetown or of other themes. It was photos of the male figure. And at that point, I was drawing on these photos. I was drawing with ink. So creating a whole new environment around the subject in the photo.
Did it start just as photographs, or did it start with photographs and other media applied?
It started, the very first exhibit I had was mixed media. Basically, I had the male figure, and all of the space around this figure had been blanked out, left white. And then I would fill it in with ink.
So where did the ink come from? Like, you know, to go from photojournalism, mm-hmm. taking photographs, there had to have been a part there where you're like, I'm going to add some paint.
I had just gotten a studio in DC, an actual studio space. I was not just working from my basement or from a table in the corner of my bedroom.
Had you done it there before you got a studio space, though?
But that's what happened. I got the studio space and I was photographing in that space, and I was inviting models and photographing these models. But at the same time, I kept on drawing in the background, drawing, you know, all sorts of things with markers, with ink. And one day I sort of had this thought, like, what if I combined the drawing and the photography? What would happen? Can I even do that? Would that work? Because that was at the time when I was really trying to see if I could make photography work as a profession outside of just being a photojournalist. And I had a close photo friend in DC who had a professional printer and who did a lot of printing. I said, is there a way to print your photos on some sort of surface where I could then draw on it and use like markers and ink? And she said, sure, there's cotton paper. You can do that on cotton paper. So the very first time I did that was in 2016. I was still living in DC and I started to draw on the pictures. And I remember very clearly putting that picture on social media and saying, I just had this sort of idea, what if I put my drawing and my pictures together? What do you guys think? And I put it out on Instagram. And the response was grand. The response was strong. People saying, oh my God, this looks amazing. Oh my God, I've never seen anything like that before. And that really was encouraging. Like, okay, well, let's do this. So I started to continue doing this, photographing more and more human figures where I would create the environment around them. And when I came to DC, to Provincetown, that's what I was doing. That's what I knew to do. And so that's what I started with. And the very first pieces I sold were of that. So it was photography, but with mixed media in it.
You don't have a lot of mixed media now. It is more art, like more painting.
Painting now.
There's a lot of evolution in there. So I want you to really talk about your eras, to use the Taylor Swift version. Yeah.
Taylor Swift is big in this studio run by Chad Rossi. Chad Rossi is the biggest Taylor Swift fan in the world.
I might be number two.
Oh, okay.
All right.
But yeah, it started with photos that I had drawn on. But then I realized that ink fades. And I went into a complete tailspin.
What do you mean ink fades?
Ink disappears.
Off of
art. Because markers, they might be permanent markers, but that's not really meant to stay there forever. So within a few months even of doing some of these works with ink, I was like, oh shit, the blue has disappeared. Especially blue, like evaporates. I was like, why is there a white line there? That used to be like a deep blue. And I completely panicked. I was like, oh my God, I am selling art that is fading. Because I felt like this was affecting my reputation and my everything. So I started calling all these conservators and art experts, and they were like, oh yeah, well, if you're using markers, that's going to happen. It. So I said, okay, well, I have to switch. I have to use paints.
Did you have customers, clients that called you and were like, hey, nobody was ever this has. Supposed to do this?
Nobody ever has. And hopefully none of them are listening right now. But on the other hand, you can also see it as it's part of the art's evolution.
It's true.
You know, the art, all art changes with time, and that one is changing its own way. So I decided, well, I have to figure something out. So I discovered paint markers. Basically, there are markers where instead of ink, it's paint. So I used those a lot. Then I decided, well, let's just use a paintbrush and start doing stuff with the paintbrush. And I started doing the same compositions with the human figure and not just drawing around it, but painting around it. And that takes us to the pandemic. Because all of a sudden, when the pandemic hit, I couldn't work in my studio anymore. So I took everything home, which I called my studio in exile. I was in the guest room. And all of a sudden, I had 3 months where there were no clients coming in. There's nobody looking over my shoulder. There's no expectations. We didn't know even if we're ever going to go back to work. So I said, well, since I have this time, let's try painting for real. And right before the pandemic, I had taken a class with Pete Hawking, who has been on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And during this class, Pete had said something that really hit me hard. And I talked about it on his podcast. He said, what were you doing when you were 7 years old? What were you drawing when you were 7 years old? Because at that point in my life, I felt I had reached, with the work I had been doing with photography and mixed media, I felt I had reached the end of it. I felt like I've done all I can do with this. And then I would just be repeating myself. But yeah, in that workshop, I was trying to push myself to paint. And Pete had said, what were you doing when you were 7 years old? And I was left with that thought right when the lockdown hit. So I went into my studio in exile at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept on painting. I just kept on trying to find ways to use paint and to transfer my ideas, my design to a canvas with paint. And it's during these 3 months of lockdown, listening to a ton of podcasts. That's when I started listening to podcasts also, that I started doing painting. And for another year or so, about a year and a half after the pandemic, I still had some mixed media photography work that was trickling in, coming to an end. But by, I think, 2022, all my work was only paintings. And I'm extremely happy doing what I'm doing now. Working as a photographer in many ways is so stressful, especially if you work with the human figure, because at least in my case, I always pay attention to the way the person that I represent feels. So if that person came to my gallery and they were on my wall and they were not happy with it, then I was not happy with it. If a model will say, well, don't use that picture, I was like, well, that's the best one. Well, don't use that one. I wouldn't use it, but I would feel sad about it. I really hated the stress of having to take the opinion of others about making art. And as a painter, then I don't have to ask anybody's permission. Can I use this picture? Do you allow me to paint on this? I could just do it very freely. And also in many ways, I grew older. I'm now 54, going on 55. Let's just sing it. I am 54, going on 55. And you know, the attraction of just photographing gorgeous men became, you know, it became like whatever. It was less of a need for me. It was less of a need for me to sort of explore the queer side, explore the voyeuristic side. It became more about expressing other feelings than just the desire that was in my previous piece of art.
Sure, you evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Your life has changed. Your vision had changed and you wanted to do something new, and it's evolution. You've talked to past artists on this podcast about that, how their work evolves over time. And I love it when you all talk about that, and you've shared where, well, you're not, let's see, what's the quote? People come into the studio and say, oh, you're not doing what you used to do, or that doesn't look like the art that I think of you with. Talk about that. That evolution and how that's been, how that's made you feel. And
it made me feel annoyed. Oh, so annoyed. I feel in many ways, when people come to Provincetown and they fall in love with Provincetown, they don't want anything to change in the Provincetown they discovered.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why when you read, for example, the community space on Facebook, mm-hmm. Provincetown community space, a lot of people bitch and complain because they came here in 1979 and Provincetown was like that in 79. And why did it change? It was manic. It was magic for me in 79 and I wanted to stay that way. And that could be in 88, in 96, whenever. Everybody feels they have an idea of Provincetown in their head and they want to keep it that way. And that includes the art. Because they come in my gallery and they expect summer to summer to summer to see the exact same art over and over again. Because that is what my gallery was to them on the first year. And they don't want anything to change in Provincetown. At least that's my theory. So a lot of artists in Provincetown have understood that. And they made a lot of money that way because there's one painting that was a big success. So every summer they recreate the exact same paintings, the exact same themes. And people come back and they love it because nothing has changed. And it's all the same. And it's reassuring and it's comforting. But I'm not like that. And so when people come to my gallery and they go, whoa, what a complete shift. I feel deeply insulted. Because I'm thinking, this is not a shift. It's a natural evolution. A shift would be if I all of a sudden would turn around and be like a performance artist. That's a shift.
Right.
But not going from one image to a slightly different image that's still on a canvas, that's still flat. I feel that sometimes people find comfort in things that don't change, while I find comfort in always trying to evolve and revolutionize who I am and what I do.
People that buy your art, have you found that you've had some that they no longer buy
a piece because
they were drawn, and that's a personal choice for them. They're drawn to something you did earlier versus what you may be doing now. And that's just their taste. It doesn't reflect on what you're creating. That's just their personal.
Yeah, no, there's definitely been a few where they come in and I see the disappointment on their faces. Like, oh, well, I guess we have a different direction now. So yes, it has happened. But honestly, my clientele keeps on growing every year. Last year, I had a record number of transactions in my gallery. So it keeps on growing.
You had someone just literally snatch something you had just finished off your desk yesterday, I just heard.
That happens, I wouldn't say regularly, but a few times a year. And that's one of the advantages of having a studio/gallery.
Working right there.
Yeah, because when they come to my gallery, it's also my working space. They see works in progress. And usually I have more than one piece that I'm working on at the same time. And it happens at least two or three times a year that people come in and go, what are you working on there?
Mm.
I go, well, it's not finished, but it's going to look like this. And, you know, this is going to be that color and this color. And they go, okay, well, I want it. And I go, well, it's not finished. And they go, well, reserve it for me. And that's happened many, many times. So what happened this week is I was working on this piece on my desk, small piece, and these were returning clients. They came in and they said, well, we bought this one piece last year and this would look great with that piece. So when you finish it, just let us know. And I said, well, it's going to be finished by tomorrow. But they came back and they bought it and another painting too.
There you go.
So yeah, these are fantastic clients. I love to see them returning.
Do you take commissions?
Rarely, but yes.
You have done some.
If it's something that I am ready to do. Meaning if people come and say, I have this vision, I want you to do this. It's like, well, that's your vision. It's not mine. If they say, okay, well, I've seen this painting and that painting and that painting, and I'd like something similar, but maybe with more blue in it. Okay, well, that's something I would do anyways, because it's already, you're looking at my paintings, you see my style, you see what I created, and you want the same thing, but in a different color. Okay, I can manage that. So yeah, when I was working with photography and I was working with the human figure, I did have more people coming in and say, well, I want you to do me like that. I want you to take pictures of me and put me in that art piece. But now that it's all paintings and there's very little in there that's human, although there's a bit in the last collections I did, there's a bit of human presence. It depends very much on what they ask. The best commission I ever had, somebody came in and said, okay, well, I need something that's, how much was it again? 10 feet long and 2.5 feet wide. And you can do whatever you want. Go. It's like, damn. So yeah, I just had to figure out how to get a canvas that big. And then I just painted whatever I want. And in his house, he built a special alcove specifically for that size, 10 feet tall, 2.5 feet wide. And my painting is there now. And regularly, I hear people coming in and say, oh, I went to so-and-so's house and I saw your painting. It's fantastic.
You're recognized now when people walk in. I mean, you do have very recognizable art, I feel.
Yeah, I'm happy about that.
Like when you walk into a house or a room, you're like, oh, that's a Gaston.
You know, a lot of people struggle with that. You know, how will I stand out as an artist? And how will I have a style? Because, you know, whenever you go to art school or art classes, whatever, there's always this idea that you have to develop your style. And for me, it came through literally decades of drawing and doing watercolors and stuff in hiding. Mm-hmm. If you look at all the work I was doing when I was young, I still have drawings that I was doing when I was 5 years old, 7 years old, 10 years old. It's very similar to what I'm doing now.
You can see a through line from stuff you did as a kid to now.
Yeah, it's strong lines and strong colors and color fields. And of course, not all the works are like that, but I can see from that moment already my attraction to strong lines and bold colors mm-hmm. and working in color fields. So I have a lot of people coming to me and say, how did you develop your style and how can I develop my style? I had a cousin come to me recently and she sent me a whole bunch of her paintings. She said, you know, you have such a distinct style. How can I do that? And I said, well, it's not something you actually do. It's something that just reveals itself over time. You just have to keep on painting. You just have to keep on working. And the more you do, the more you'll establish patterns and comfort zones and artistic and aesthetic things that you like. And this will come with time, but you know, it doesn't come by just saying, my style will be this. It comes by working so long that eventually the style develops into what it is, develops itself.
So let's talk about that style. One of my favorite things that you do with guests is say, so what do you do? How do you do that? Phil Jimenez, when he talked you through how he crafts a comic book page, mm-hmm. Trevor sharing that it's just literally oil paint and a palette knife. There have been many others that have shared how they create their art. Share with us how you create your art.
Yeah, and that's a question I get all the time in my gallery because people expect, you know, they'll get in a gallery where there's a painter. They expect the stereotypical, you know, you have a paintbrush and just go at the canvas and you dabble and move things around. And no, I often say that I don't paint a painting, I construct a painting. So first thing I do, I take a canvas. And if I remember, because I often forget, I will do a very nice thick coat of gesso on it. Gesso is basically a base layer you put on a painting so that the paint can adhere to it. Because just putting paint directly on a canvas, it doesn't always adhere that well.
Do you only work on canvas or do you work on wood like also. A piece of wood? Okay.
Wood. I would also, mostly canvas, but some wood. Okay. But sometimes I forget to do that layer of gesso and then I regret it because I work with tape and then you pull up the tape and all the paint comes up under it. But yeah, so I start by doing a layer of gesso on. Then I start usually drawing directly on the canvas. With a pencil. The idea of the upcoming painting is clear in my head. I'm one of these people that I can see images in my head very clearly. I know exactly what things will look like before I even start.
Where do you get that inspiration?
The inspiration comes from what I answer my clients, because I get that question 10 times a day. I said the inspiration comes from just being here, because it comes both from the natural environment that I'm in, but also it comes from the extremely rich historical legacy that we have in this town. A lot of my paintings are influenced by other works that were done by other artists in this town in the past, but they're also influenced by paying attention to light on water, paying attention to patterns that I can find in the dunes, or looking at the interaction of beach umbrellas on the beach. So I start drawing directly on the canvas. And if I'm going to do a beach umbrella painting, well, I start right away with the compass and measuring all the angles, and I draw it on. After the composition is fully drawn, I have hundreds of little color swatches. These are every single color that I use, or that I've mixed, or that I can function with. And I take all these swatches out and I start planning. Okay, well, if I'm working on these beach umbrellas, this one, okay, I want it to be more blue. So I'll take out all the blues and then I start putting in yellows and reds or whatever. And I choose a combination through my color swatches, and then I color code everything. So every single color field, every single space that's been drawn on my canvas gets a code. And I just know these codes by heart. I know sometimes they're letters, sometimes they're numbers. So I just have to look, and I know that number 9 is cerulean blue. I know that RS is raw sienna. I know that LPH is light phthalo green. I just have these clear ideas in my head of what these codes are. So I code the whole thing. And sometimes, especially if I work on my paintings, which are based on ships in a harbor, these are extremely intricate, and sometimes there's thousands of color fields, but each one of them gets a little code in it. And I do that to make sure I don't end up with color fields that overlap.
Now, this is on the canvas. This isn't on like iPad.
Directly on the canvas.
Like, easily map this out and delete it if it goes wrong. This is on the canvas.
I draw directly on the canvas. That's incredible. And there's actually very little erasing going on, because, as I said, I see the image in my head. I know exactly what it's going to be. I just have to transfer it from my brain to the canvas. And it's all color coded, and then basically becomes color by number. And I use a lot of tape in my compositions, because it is a hard edge technique, which means the color fields have hard edges. And I have tape for straight lines, and also tape that's flexible for curved lines. But I still do a lot of curves and circles freehand. Sometimes it's just easier to skip the tape. And so, yeah, then I start working. And the drawing and color planning process can take anything from a couple hours to 3 days, depending on how large the composition is. And then the painting process, it's a very long, tedious thing. And that's why I listen to a lot of podcasts when I paint, because at this moment, I'm just constructing the painting. It's all planned out. I don't have to think about it. I'm not thinking about the painting. I'm thinking about filling in the information that I already put on the canvas. So I listen to a lot of podcasts at that time to keep my brain occupied. And at the end, well, you have a finished composition. And sometimes little paintings, like even ones that are 6x6, will take me just as long as those that are like 24x24 inches, depending on how intricate they are, depending on how much color I have to mix, depending on a whole bunch of factors.
You mentioned hard edge. That's the type of painting that you're doing. And in a previous episode, you talked about Nassos
Daphnis
and how he was a hard edge painter here. And you had this connection. You got so excited. Have you found more? Is that something that this podcast has brought you?
I was
finding more work like what you're doing.
I was going to teach a class at the museum on hard edge painting. But over the winter, registrations were down in art classes, and I didn't get enough people. So the class didn't happen. But because of that, the museum gave me digital access to all of their archives of the collection. And I went through all the paintings they have in the collection and picked out a bunch of paintings that were sort of in the hard edge spirit. And there were a lot of them. There's also, for example, Ross Moffat, who's a well-known Provincetown painter who did a lot of his paintings in color fields. There was Nassos Daphnis, and there was a few others. Oh, Fritz Bultmann also worked a lot in color fields and hard edge. And for me, that was encouraging. I get so many people who come to my gallery and say, well, this is not Provincetown at all. And in their head, Provincetown art is what came from the Charles Hawthorne tradition. Charles Hawthorne, who was working in the Impressionist style, and that's what he was teaching here, and that's a tradition that kept on going. But then in the 1930s, you have Hans Hofmann coming to Provincetown, and Hans Hofmann was here through the 30s, 40s, 50s, and maybe also the 60s, I don't remember exactly, but he was all about expressing yourself on canvas with whatever shape you're going to put it there. Very abstract, very much based on the impact of color and impact of shapes. And through Hans Hofmann, that's how you had all the big names in 20th century art come here. Mark Rothko, Helen Frankenthaler, Lee Krasner, Jackson Pollock, a whole bunch of big names of in art came to work here in Provincetown. So there is a strong tradition here of modernism, of working with strong colors, of working on impactful compositions, and not just trying to work on natural themes with an impressionistic style. So, yeah, when I saw the work of Naso Stefanis and a few others, it was sort of emboldening me, like, oh yeah, you said this is not Provincetown? Well, I'll show you Provincetown. And I have this idea in my head, maybe I should not declare it in public, but maybe one day when I finally have time, I would really like to curate an exhibit at the museum, which would be about exploring line and color in Provincetown art history, where I dig through their archives and find these paintings that are more in a tradition of hard edge, color fields, and impactful lines and colors. Maybe at the moment, I'm a bit overwhelmed, but maybe in time I'll do it.
That sounds amazing. What other hard edges? You use tape. What are other painters using for a hard edge?
That's pretty much what you use.
Tape, okay.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people do it freehand. Or they will use, for example, a ruler that they put on the canvas and they just paint with the ruler there. And then they remove the ruler and they have a straight line. But I'm pretty much self-taught in that technique. Oh. I did look up a few things on YouTube. YouTube is fantastic. Anything, any question you have on technique or color mixing or whatever, it's there. For example, I have learned recently with Elspeth Slayer to do gel plate printing.
I was just going to ask about the new thing you're playing with that I saw in your studio. So
gel plate printing. And yesterday I was trying to do something, which I know you can do because I've seen it in other gel plates, but I couldn't figure out how to do it. I just went on on YouTube and looked at a dozen videos, and then I accomplished it. And I wrote Elspeth. I said, oh my God, I did it. And now she wants to learn more about it. So the way I taught myself was by using tape. And it works very well for me. And it was a lot of trial and error. Because honestly, if you just put tape on a canvas and paint, it's not going to work. It's a whole process.
How many rolls of tape are on your average painting?
It depends on the size. Mm. But it's a lot of tape.
It's a lot.
Yeah, I order my tape by the dozen. Rolls of tape by the dozen.
Blue tape. Blue painter's tape.
And I go through it about every 2 months. I have to order another roll of 12. And I have a lot of different types of tape also. Depending on what I'm doing and where on the painting and what I want to achieve, I have 6 or 7 different types of tapes that will create different effects. And then there's also working with sealant to seal the edge to make sure that, because the canvas is not a flat surface, it's a weave. If you put paint on it, well, the paint's going to seep through the weave under the tape. So I figured it out and it's working for me.
We've talked about you need to make some type of sculpture with all the blue tape that you peel off your paintings, because we walked in and we're like, oh, he's doing a different form of art.
Yeah. Sometimes I end up with a big pile next to me because I'm painting, I'm in it, I'm in the zone, and I don't have time to like put it in the garbage can. So I just tape it on the edge of my table. And sometimes by the end of the day, I have something that's like 2 feet tall.
How do you know when something's finished? I mean, with the way you work, it sounds like you know when it's finished, when your design is completed.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're not like adding a happy little tree over here and a little cloud over there.
And that's a question I get very, very often in my gallery, because that's something people are used to asking artists. But that would apply mostly to artists who are working, you know, with more in the impressionistic style, as I said earlier, with, you know, freehand brushes on the canvas. In my case, everything is so precisely planned before I even put a drop of paint on the canvas that I don't have to say, well, I'm done now, because it's already built in. The end is built in.
Do you sign your name on your art?
Front and back.
front and back.
I cannot understand artists who don't. And I've had this discussion with a few artists who don't. And I keep on saying, and that comes actually a lot from my experience with photography. When I was a photographer and the age of internet really hit, all of a sudden my pictures, especially from that Captive series, all of a sudden they were being published all over the world. All of a sudden somebody had a print of them in their house. All of a sudden they were in a gallery show in Switzerland. I'm like, what the hell? I never gave permission for any of this. I never got any money for all of this. The pictures were being stolen and reproduced, and people were taking just, you know, from screen grabs, and people were taking ownership of my work. And that's one of the reasons I started drawing and painting on prints, because I was annoyed that in photography, people can easily take a screen grab from the internet and steal your work. But if every print is made unique by making a mark on it, either with ink or with paint, then screw you, it's mine. And also putting my signature on it. So I always sign the front and I always sign the back. Sometimes when the painting's very small, I'll sign the side because my signature gets to be too intrusive on the front. But yeah, I'm very intent on really marking my ownership of this art. This is mine, my signature's on it, and you can't have it unless you pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's great. Are you making stuff now that you couldn't have made 5 years ago? Or, you know, have you learned technique and things?
Oh, yeah.
Or was it just like, oh, I hadn't thought of that yet?
Definitely. I keep on learning new techniques and new tricks on a very regular basis. Usually that happens when I want to create something and my brain cannot wrap itself around it with the tools I currently have. Then, as I said, I'll go look on YouTube.
Hence this new gelled printing. You're wanting to try something.
Well, I love printing. I do a lot of printing. I do silkscreen printing. I do monotype printing. These are classes I took at Castle Hill Center for the Arts in Truro. And I'm very lucky that the Fine Arts Work Center every year gives me 1 week in their print lab as a residency. And I just sit there for a week and I print all I can. Then I use these products in my gallery. The fun thing about gel plate printing is that every print is a one of a kind. And it's also something I can easily do on my table at work. I don't need a lot of extra equipment. I don't need big machines and chemicals and big water sinks, which I need for the other techniques. That one, it can be very compact and it can be done almost anywhere. So if I can find a way to, you know, incorporate that in my work, then it's not always a painting. It can be something like a print that's sometimes more accessible financially. And sometimes people don't want a 4x4 foot painting. They just want a little thing to put on their wall so they can aim for print. But yeah, that's where that comes from.
The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So we're an hour in and we're only getting to the podcast. So this is a good conversation. Dad's going to have his editing work. So you've spent 50 episodes inside other artist processes and many different artists, types. Hearing how they see and how they work, what they protect, their process. Has any of that found its way into your studio? Has making this podcast changed the way you produce art?
I will say yes, but I can't put my finger on it yet. The thing I have loved the most, and I haven't done it enough, but is before the interview going to visit an artist in their studio. And then seeing the work as it's happening in the studio and then talking about the processes and talking about, you know, the thinking behind the art. And in all these situations, I come back home with a little bit more insight in what it means to be an artist and how you can create the art. And this, I'm sure, is seeping into the way I create and the way I function. Just an example, Megan Hilton, who is somebody I connected with so deeply when I first went to her studio. We felt we were almost like twins speaking the same language, a secret language. And she was talking a lot about how she gains inspiration from works coming from historical artists, from mm-hmm. other artists. And I had done work in the past that was inspired by Marston Hartley, who spent some time here in Provincetown. And I almost felt guilty thinking that, you know, well, it's inspired by Marston Hartley. Is it really mine? I don't want to steal his work. But then talking to Megan and sort of ideating through the process of gaining inspiration from others really gave me confidence in saying, hey, you know what? This was inspired by Marston Hartley, but it's uniquely mine. And I'm very thankful for Marston Hartley and what he did. And I'm very honored that I can continue it. And seeing the way she was working with historical artists and incorporating that into her artist statement and into her work really gave me more confidence to do the same. And now I have this sort of ache to learn more about other artists who are in Provincetown to see how they might imprint on me and eventually lead to, you know, evolution in my work. But yeah, I think a lot of the answer to this question will be clearer in maybe 4 or 5 years. It's hard to know right now what will exactly change my way of working.
Well, that brings us to this podcast. We've talked about the person and the art, and now we're going to move on to the podcast. But before we do that, it's that part of the show where you usually do your thing. So the floor is yours.
Oh, yes. As a reminder, please follow us on Instagram at The Art Colony Podcast. And if you would like to support the podcast and help keep us on the air, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com. You can go there and do a search for The Art Colony Podcast, and you can leave us a little tip. And thank you to all of those who have helped us up to now. There, I did my spiel.
You did your spiel. Buy me a coffee. You're going to buy me a coffee?
Yeah, sure.
All right. I want to take us back to the beginning. Episode 1, August 5th, 2025. You walked in here alone, no guest, just you and a microphone. And you talked for 40 plus minutes about the history of this town, about the pilgrims and the Portuguese fishermen and the whaling area and Charles Hawthorne and Eugene O'Neill and what it meant for Provincetown to become the oldest continuous art colony in the United States. And at the end of that episode, you said something, and I want to hold you to it.
Okay.
You said, I have a great curiosity about this place. I want to learn more. I'm hoping to learn more through this podcast by talking to people who know more than I do. But you also said something else. You posed a specific question you could not answer. You ask, how did Charles Hawthorne know to come here in 1899? Who told him? You said the information was not complete. 50 conversations later, have you found that answer?
I'm trying to remember now who answered that question for me. Somebody on the podcast, I can't remember exactly who now, did explain to me how the idea of art colonies was very popular in Europe in the late 1800s, and that was taken to North America. And Charles Hawthorne had been going to art colonies in the Northeast, and he had gotten this idea of, you know, making his own. And from there, he had heard from other people about this cool place called Provincetown, and he came over and started the colony here. And another point, that episode was recorded actually in May of 2025, because I recorded episodes for 3 months before releasing them. And that first time I sat here with the microphone, I was nervous, but I was excited. And also the microphone kept on falling down because I didn't know how to work a lot of that technique around here. And I panicked because I was like screaming, Chad, Chad, because he couldn't hear me in the control room back there. But if you look on YouTube for the whole episode, I'm holding the microphone with my hands. So I learned how to do it now. I don't have to worry about it anymore. But that was launching a fun journey.
After 50 conversations with historians, artists, and people who have been here since the 1970s, did you learn what you hoped to learn, or did the podcast take you somewhere you didn't expect to go?
Yes and yes. I always find it fascinating to talk to people who were here in previous years. Because remember I said earlier, you know, everybody comes here at a time and they discover Provincetown as a magical place, and they want that to stay. They want to keep the magic from that time. So that's why when a lot of people come here, I ask them about their first time in Provincetown. I want to hear what the magic was for them. What is it that captivated them and wanted them to come back and again and again? I love hearing these stories. I love hearing about businesses that have come and gone. I love hearing about characters who have come and gone. And it just, it really enriches my whole perception of this place. So it's a fun conversation to have. I really loved hearing Bert Yarborough talking about the Fine Arts Work Center in the 70s. That was really fun to hear because right now we think of the Fine Arts Work Center as this big, globally important art center with people coming from all around the world. But when he talks about how scrappy it was in the 70s and how people had to deal with, you know, less than ideal living conditions, but they still were pushing through it and making great art. Yeah, that was great. I didn't expect the Fine Arts Work Center at that time to be as scrappy as it was, but it's great to see how it has evolved and how it's become, you know, a global center of art excellence.
You said you started this because 70 hours at the gallery were keeping you from the community you moved here to be a part of. Has that worked? Are you more connected to Provincetown now than you were before you launched? Or has it just added more work to your plate and you're working harder?
The connection is indescribable. I feel this podcast has changed everything for me. I'm trying not to get emotional now. But in 2023, I went through a very difficult time. My mother passed away. I had a full-on burnout. I was working too much, and I was trying really hard to keep up with the crowd in Provincetown. I sort of hadn't fully yet realized that I'm not a tourist in this town. So every week, there was a new group coming in, and I was trying to be, you know, with it and go to tea and go to the beach and try to meet all my friends. I had a complete burnout. So after that, I kept on thinking of different ways for me to interact with this town, different ways for me to still meet people, still get the fulfillment and nourishment I need from this town, but without burning out. And as I said, I listened to a lot of podcasts. So that was already in my head. And at that time, I had two close friends who started their own podcast. It was here in the same studio, the Circle podcast. It was Tim Bish and Eric Beaumier. They did that podcast for 1 year, and I was close friends with both of them. And that's when I sort of had this realization, well, maybe I should do a podcast too. And for me, it was both to honor the tradition of Provincetown art and honor the history on which my whole career is built. But it was also for me a tool to be able to interact with this town differently, a tool for me to meet people that I don't get to just sit down with and talk. In this town, there's a lot of socializing going on, but often it's over alcohol, it's over loud music, it's over noisy restaurants. I have a lot of trouble dealing with noisy spaces. I'm very misophonic. If you don't know what that is, you can look it up, which means I'm deeply affected by my audio space, and that will have a deep effect on my mood. So in a lot of social situations, I have a lot of trouble socializing, but on a podcast, one-on-one, I can really, you know, get to know that person, dig in, have a real conversation. And now I feel that when I go anywhere public, the podcast becomes something that sort of lubricates my social interactions now. I'm meeting a lot of new people in new spaces. I'm getting a lot more information and interaction with the community that I didn't have before. And I feel my status has completely changed. I feel that I would go to events before and I was just another wallflower, another artist in this town. But now I go to events and I feel like I fit here. People want to talk to me here and I have something to say and they have something to say. And I found, you know, the right place to be. So the podcast has been fantastic for me, both in terms of learning and disseminating information, but also in terms of defining my spot, my space in this town, defining who I am in this town.
Well, it's been fantastic for all of us. I mean, I think I loved hearing you say that, but I also love what you've done for Provincetown and for all of us that love it the same way, you know, you do. We all love it in our own unique ways. And this has been such a way to discover more about it, things that you would have never learned. I remember those first few episodes about the history of the art colony and just like, it was just incredible. And you really, I mean, you've made a special community, and I think you're the heart of that community, and you are really good at doing your research to interview those people, to grow that community, to grow that perspective and that history. And you're really good at talking about it. And I just want to thank you because it's been incredible. You've created a special community around this.
Thank you. Well, one thing I want to add about that, another reason why the podcast exists is because I had been hearing too often by too many people, the art colony's over. There are no more real artists in Provincetown. Somebody came to my gallery about 2 years ago saying, I remember when there were real artists in this town. And, you know, another podcaster from this town had went viral last year for saying something like, you know, this town has gotten so expensive. Nobody who's a self-respecting artist can live here anymore. And everybody's left and there's nobody left. I was like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about your experience. You're talking about you. This is not the colony. And so it was sort of a mission of mine to put it out there that all the naysayers on community space and on other spaces who just say things like the art colony is over and there's no more artists here, you are so wrong. And I will prove it to you because I have now interviewed 49 people and my waiting list is still extremely long because this town is full of people who are working in the arts, all the arts, and it's a colony that is thriving and it needs global attention. And I hope I can help with that.
I'm Susie Welch, the host of Becoming You, a podcast where I help you stop living by default and start living by design. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I love that you feel that you're more connected now. You definitely have connected so many to the history and the legacy of Provincetown. What's the most moving thing you've witnessed as a community member? Because you've started this show, not an interview, not a conversation in this studio. What did you see or attend or experience because of the podcast that has really stuck with you or changed you or that you've been proud of?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is something that happened in the studio. Working with Marion Roth, who I think she said she was 80, going on 81, and hearing her perspective as an artist in her senior years and saying that, you know, when you're young, you keep on thinking about what am I going to do next? What's my next series? What's my next trip? What's my next? And then you get at her age and you have to moderate these thoughts. You know, will I have a chance for a new trip or a new series? So she was saying, because of that, I live a lot more in the now.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the sentence, I'm looking back, but I'm also looking forwards. And that was a deeply moving reflection on what it means to be an artist as you age. Outside of this studio, well, I think the one thing that has moved me the most is when people make the effort to come to my gallery just to tell me, I love your podcast. And that means so much to me. And just to know people are listening and people are listening and they feel so good that they will come to my gallery to tell me about it. That often really touches me deeply.
Is there an episode that stayed with you the longest after the conversation in here? Have you gone home and thought about something, you know, days later?
Every single person I've interviewed, I have re-listened afterwards to the podcast for at least 3 to 5 times. Because often when I'm doing this and I'm talking to them, my mind is so focused on keeping the ball rolling that sometimes I will miss details or I won't remember details. So when I re-listen to the episode, often I gain some wisdom that I had sort of forgotten or glanced over the first time around. So everybody gets multiple listens afterwards from me.
What's been harder than you expected? Not a specific guest, the work itself. What does the show ask of you that you did not anticipate? You've spoken a little bit more about
social media,
how present you are during the interview.
Yeah.
You also study very hard before.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything that comes after you actually do the interview.
Yeah, the for me, the toughest part is what comes after the interview. I really enjoy doing the research and finding out and preparing my questions and, you know, having fun with trying to get like the fun questions for the speed round at the end and stuff like that. And doing the interview itself, for me, it's a huge thrill to do it. But afterwards, Chad edits all the episodes and he sends me the edit. And from there, I create clips for social media. And that's a whole half day of work just listen to the whole episode, trying to figure out what are pieces that can be highlighted on social media without giving away too much, ways to hook the people to come in or to leave suspense, and then creating, I have to create 5 clips every week for every episode, and then remembering to put them on social media. There are some days where I go, oh damn, I forgot, so I have to put them on. So that's a lot of work that I was not anticipating, but you know, you need to do that. Otherwise nobody will know you exist. You need to be on social media somehow.
A lot of work.
It is.
It's a lot of hustle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you have the gallery as well. It really is astonishing. It's mind-blowing. I'm so in awe of everything you're doing. And I think a lot of other people are, and you can hear it when you interview them and they make their comments back to you. To the podcast again, why do you think this hasn't been done before, this preservation of Provincetown history? I mean, look at what you're doing. There are institutions in town that have it done, that have done this in different ways, preserving written historical timelines.
Mm-hmm.
There are some, but they haven't captured in this way the history, the stories, the details that you have captured. You're just a artist on Commercial Street that decided that they wanted to do this. There are other institutions that are like set to do this, like their mission. But you've done it and it's created such a huge impact and it's going to live on in perpetuity, this history that you've documented. You know, have you thought about that?
Absolutely. No, I'm very aware that other people and institutions are doing similar things. The Arts Foundation of Cape Cod has a podcast too. And at WYMR, Jeanette de Beauvoir, who was one of my guests, also has a regular talk, interview, show, podcast. So there are others doing it as well. But I am thrilled that somehow my take on this has taken off and people are listening. And one thing I do almost obsessively is watch my listener numbers every day to see if, you know, if I'm staying on trend or going up. And at the moment, you know, the numbers keep on growing, and I keep on having people listening from faraway countries that I never heard of. I think in a lot of ways, what maybe makes my podcast different is my background as a historian, my background doing research in these things and having a deep interest about it and knowing how to talk about it and present it and also inquire about it. And also in my training as a historian in university, I did a lot of classes in oral history, which are all about how to interview people to get long answers out, not just a yes or no answer. And also when I was working as a photojournalist, I did a lot of video work where I had to interview a lot of people. So I have these skills that have developed through multiple jobs in the past. And maybe that's why I guess I can weave a story that keeps people's attentions and it's creates something that's worthwhile to listen to. I hope so anyways. But, and I'm just so honored that people have decided to tune in. Really, when I started this, it was just, let's make 12 episodes and see what happens.
Wow.
And when we had the launch for the podcast at the museum, we did not have a big crowd. We had maybe less than 40 people show up and we were worried, but I kept on telling Chad, I was telling my producer, Chad Rossi, no, I think this will have an audience. I think this will reach the right people. And with every new episode, we're reaching more and more. And I'm so happy about that. And I'm so honored that people are, you know, tuning into my show. It's great.
So I want to ask about something I have not heard you address directly in any episode I listened to. You haven't talked about it today yet. But you're a gay man. You're documenting a queer town. I think this is one of the few places in the world that queer actually works for an entire community, the people in it, the place. You covered Marion Roth and the AIDS crisis that took place here. You've covered Regina Binder and her projects to put LGBT historical markers on places that mattered to our community here. There's a lot of them. And you're doing all of this in 2025 and 2026 in today's America. In your first episode, before you had brought in a single guest, you said, I think we may look back and say the 2020s were such a great time for art in Provincetown. You said that on day one. What do you think now?
Well, I think that's what I'm really shining a light on. And that was a reaction to this other podcaster or the people on Community Space saying, the art colony's over. I was like, no, you are full of beans. This is a thriving colony. I'm going to shine a spotlight on it. I'm going to show you that there's great stuff happening here right now. Stuff that you will not see in New York. You will not see in Los Angeles. It's happening right here. So that's something that I was really aiming for. And on the queer side, there's another podcast that had been doing episodes about Provincetown, not a local podcast. And they had been interviewing local artists and gallery owners for a few years. They did just a few episodes a year. And in all these episodes, the word queer or gay or LGBT maybe twice came up over the space of about 10 episodes. And it was always a by the way. So oddly enough, this same podcast interviewed me last week. And for the whole interview, it was queer, 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 queer. That's all I said. You cannot overlook the fact that in this town right now, in this art colony, the vast majority of people who are artists, gallery owners, and work in art institutions, they are queer. What is driving the spirit of this art colony right now is in large part the queer community. And I will not be silent about it. I will not be diplomatic about it. I will make it clear that this art colony is due to queer people in a large part. There's still a lot of straight people, a lot. I mean, there's a club in town where I've been invited multiple times. It's like a secret club. And everybody there is straight. So there is also huge amounts of straight artists and, you know, people working in the community. But nowhere in the world we have this type of queer presence that's making this type of impact. Nowhere in the world. So that other podcast, when they interviewed me, it's called The American Art Collective. You can look it up. I really made a point of being very clear about the fact that this is a thriving art colony, but you cannot put aside the fact that this is a queer art colony as well. Not that it's exclusive in any way, but queer people are really the beating heart of it.
It's some crazy times right now, and art and Provincetown are more important than ever. Let's look forward. 50 episodes in. A live one-year anniversary event coming up. You've got potential sponsorships, maybe a grant or two you're considering applying for.
Oh, I already got two.
All right. And there's more out there, I know. You just got to keep looking because you've got an incredible product to apply for those grants with.
Yes, somebody has to pay Chad. Somebody has to pay for this studio.
That's right. Because it does cost money.
It does. And Chad has this amazing studio, the Provincetown Recording Studios, with a lot of equipment that cost him a lot of money. And with two rooms to record in. So when he took me in, it was for free. But I can't do that eternally. So I have been using all this grant money to pay for Chad, helping him to pay for the rent and the equipment, and keeping a little bit for my own research and development. But I need somehow to compensate Chad for his amazing help and support and work in maintaining this podcast.
So the live one-year anniversary event. Tell people about that.
We are planning to have it on July 21st at the Commons. It will be a live audience recording. We'll have a few guests in front and we'll be recording an episode and taking questions from the audience and marking the 1 year since the launch of the podcast. And a lot of it is still in the works right now, so it's hard to say more details, but I'm looking forward to it and I'm very thankful for the participation of the Commons, and also of the Provincetown Art Gallery Association, which will co-sponsor that event.
Is there a gap in 50 episodes that bothers you, a voice or story you feel you owe an audience?
My partner keeps on saying, you need to do something on poetry. And it's hard for me because I don't read poetry. And it's not because it's not good or I don't see it as worthy, but it's not something that I'm automatically attracted to. And so for me to do an episode on poetry, I feel like I wouldn't really know what to ask.
Oh, I think you would come up with plenty of questions to ask anybody.
Yeah. So yes, that's one thing I haven't touched at all yet. And something that I feel is a big part of Provincetown history with Mary Oliver, with Harry Kemp, with a lot of other authors who are here right now also creating poetry. Thinking of Andy Toll, for example, who's a painter now, but he first came here as a poetry resident at the Fine Arts Work Center. So maybe in time, I'll find a way to get a poet here or somebody who knows about poetry and do an episode, but it hasn't happened yet. And I'm very conscious of it.
How do you find your guests? And also, how do potential guests find you? Is that an option?
Usually, I made a long list of people that I feel would be great guests on the podcast. Some I know, some I don't. A lot of them are people I know already. So it's just a question of texting or email or finding them on Facebook or Instagram. Those that I don't know, it can be a bit more stressful. And I've had multiple situations where I have to send email after email after email. But I eventually always reach them. A few of them has said no. One of them was the very first person on my list and somebody that keeps on coming up on the podcast and somebody that people keep on saying, you need to have him on the podcast. He was the very first person I asked and he said no. And I've gone back to him multiple times and he says, I love your podcast. You do an amazing job, but I don't want to talk about myself. So that has happened too. I've had two people turn me down and it's okay. It's fine.
Well, I would just say to those people, you haven't told me who they are, but it's not talking about yourself. It is sharing with history and with the community that we all love what you've brought to it. So I hope they would reconsider.
I hope so too.
And then I'm sure you're aware with some of them locking them in before the story is lost, you know, making sure that we're capturing that person in that moment.
There's two things I keep on thinking when I approach these people who have been here for a very long time. I tend to prefer to invite people who have not had as much of a chance to be highlighted. Mm. There's a number of artists here who are legendary, but they've already had 3 documentaries done about them. They've already had a full-length film done about them. They've already had books written about them. And these people come up very often in my suggestions. You should really have so-and-so on your podcast. And I go, yeah, I agree. However, this other artist who's the same age, has been here 40 years, what do you know about her?
Right. And those people are bringing up that name because they do have so much attention already that they're able to be known.
So I'm not saying that these people will never be on the podcast. Sure. I'm saying for the moment, I have been giving priority to artists who have received less exposure. Yeah, there's a few of them that I know I would have to reach them soon because they're very, very elderly. But on the other hand, I'm reassured by knowing that when I did research on these people,
there's a lot of
information already.
So what do you want this show? I mean, we're about to wrap up. What do you want this show to be? Where do you see it? Is this, are we going to be talking in 5 years? Am I going to do the 5-year anniversary?
I don't know. It's really going one episode at a time. Eventually I'll get to a point where either I run out of guests or I have to reinvite the same people over and over again. There's always going to be a lot of information, but there will be a point where it will get thin. But what I want this podcast to be, and this goes back to my training as a historian, I want this to be a historical document. I want this to be something that people can refer to over the years and hear the stories from the mouths of the people who actually were living through these times. I said in one of my podcasts that when I first moved to the U.S., to D.C., and I had no work permit, no visa, no nothing, I started volunteering at the Smithsonian Institution. And they put me in the Archives of American Art. And they would give me these reels of interviews that were done with artists in the 1960s. And on these reels, you had artists in their studio talking about their process, talking about their work, talking about their lives at that moment in 1968. And I thought that was just such a fascinating listen because it was not a book. It was not a retrospective book. It was not an exhibit looking at, you know, from the age of 18 to the age of 88. It was now, where am I sitting now? What am I doing now? What's my work right now? What's my philosophy now? And I loved translating those episodes or transcribing those episodes, those reels. So I want my podcast to be something like that. Be something where, you know, in 2068, somebody can listen to what happened here in 2026 and get an idea of who were the people, what were they doing, what were they thinking, what was their mindset specifically in 2026.
I'm Dana Carvey.
I'm David Spade.
Fly on the Wall's back for another season now on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
So many incredible guests will be joining us.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Too good to be true.
All right. right. Well, we're in that last section of the podcast that you started a little while ago. It's mandatory. And we have to do the speed round.
I stole that from Amy Poehler. Amy Poehler's a podcast I really love listening to because she's so funny and she's so witty, but she does this once in a while, the speed round. And I was thinking I need something to sort of liven up the podcast at the end and bring a bit of humor in. So I stole the speed round from her.
Well, and I'm just copying it from you. Okay. So I'm going to give you two choices. You have to pick one and you have to justify your choice.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You ready?
Yes.
You were a photojournalist for 8 years. You've been a painter for 9. Which one do you enjoy more and which one speaks more truth?
Painter for sure. As I said earlier, working in photography, I really hated having to always take in consideration other people's spaces, other people's opinions, other people's prejudices. I found photography to be enormously stressful at all times. But painting, I find the opposite, extremely peaceful, extremely reassuring. And when I take photos, I often felt that I was constrained by what the assignment was or what people were hiring me for. So I felt the photos were not necessarily talking about my truth.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I have an accent sometimes. But in painting, it's something that I'm creating in my own time, at my own pace, with my own intention. So I feel that's much more true, and I much prefer doing that.
Herring Cove or Race Point?
I think I'd say Race Point. First of all, I don't go to the beach.
Okay, well, so neither.
I don't lie down in a towel and get fried on the beach. I did that for a while, but I discovered it's really not me. I hate having sunscreen in my eyes. I hate having sand in every single crevice. And I always feel like I'm wasting time. I could be using that time, even if it's just relaxing at home, better. But Race Point, I drove for the dune tours for mm-hmm. a while. And I really enjoyed with the dune tours going to Race Point at sunset. I remember once I had this group of lesbians. They were all in their late 80s. They had been friends for like 70 years. They had all gone to school together or something. And they wanted a bonfire and a dinner by the beach after the dune tour. And as I'm preparing the bonfire, literally 50 feet from us, a whale surfaced.
Oh.
And to the point where we could feel and smell the spray in the air. And that was such an amazing experience. It was so close. That's not something I think you can get at Herring Cove, but at Race Point, because it's much deeper.
Yeah.
You can. So yeah. And whenever I go to Race Point, I want to see a shark too, but I've never seen a shark.
I'm a Herring Cove fan.
Yeah.
So that's where we do our bonfires and mm-hmm. watch the sunset. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Making art or talking about art?
I probably would say making art. For me, that's such a catharsis, making art. And it's, even though it's a lot of work, I'm really at peace when I do it. But I love talking about art. I love talking about art history and characters in the past. And almost all the podcasts I listen to are about art history. And as I said, when I met Megan Hinton for the first time, and we started just going off about art, I felt like I was lifting off the ground because it was so great to have a great conversation about art. But if I had to choose just one, I would say making art.
Probably wouldn't have this if you didn't have the other.
Yeah.
Latvia or Provincetown? Which one had a bigger impact on you?
They both had a fantastic, dramatic impact. But as I said at the beginning, the reason we had to leave Provincetown was because homophobia was...
Latvia.
Sorry. We left Latvia because homophobia,
hopefully we never have to leave Provincetown for homophobia.
Homophobia was really strong. Now, it's changed a lot. As I said, we had formed this organization. We were 16 friends. We formed Mosaika, which is the Latvian LGBT organization. It was a rough start. I mean, a lot of vandalism and attacks and stuff. But now, which is 20 years later, that organization is one of the strongest LGBT organizations in all of Eastern Europe. A lot of my colleagues from then have become heads of international or global LGBT organizations. So we started something great there. Things are changing. Latvia now has official partnerships, not marriage yet, but partnerships. And a lot of people I worked with back then and a lot of people I mentored when I was there are now really the vanguard of the LGBT movement in Latvia. So it's changing. But being in Provincetown and never having to think about that.
Yeah.
Never having to think about Where am I? What am I doing? What am I saying? Who am I with? Is this a safe place? What time of the night is it? Right. That frees up so much brain space. It frees up so much brain energy.
Yeah.
You just get rid of all these self-protection mechanisms. And I think that's where a lot of the magic of Provincetown lies.
I think
is that it rewires your brain.
Totally is.
And so, yeah, if I had to choose Latvia or Provincetown, I would definitely choose Provincetown, but I'd like to visit Latvia more often. Yeah.
I would choose Provincetown as well. I'm Nashville half the year and mm-hmm. here half the year and been in Nashville 26 years, but this is home. I'm a wash ashore and just working to get here full time. And I think it is, there's a magic and I think there is this acceptance that makes that magic possible
mm-hmm.
where you feel safe. And I already know this answer to okay. the last question. In the Liz Carney episode, you said, if I die, when I die, I want the buffet to be all pies, savory pies and sweet pies, mm-hmm. just pies. So pies or brownies?
Pies.
Of course. Pies.
But yes. As I also said in that episode, I really have to watch my sugar intake. I'm not diabetic, but on my father's side of the family, a lot of people are hyperglycemic and sugar has a huge effect on my mood, on my level of awakeness. You know, when they had the French bakery in Wellfleet, which is very sadly closed now, I would stop and get something there. And afterwards, I was in a complete coma for half a day because of the amount of sugar. So yes, I adore sweet pies, but I probably would be better with just the chicken pot pie.
Last question. You open every episode by asking your guests to tell their story. You spend the whole episode holding the space for someone else. Today, you sat in that chair. Instead, and what was it like to be the one answering?
I think it was a lot less stressful than being the one asking questions. I felt it was much easier to be present and be cognitively active because I didn't have to think of what's the next question. Do I have to come back to this hook? And did I do this justice? Do we have to return to that? Because when I'm interviewing, my brain is, it's like it has multiple tentacles going at the same time, and I'm trying to make sure every one of them reaches the final destination. And so it's a lot of brain energy.
Yeah.
And being in this chair, I felt it was more about just saying, me, 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 me. And that was easier.
Well, you make it look easy when you do this. And again, it was an honor to be on in this chair. Gaston, this has been a genuine pleasure. 50 episodes of asking other people who they are. Thank you for finally letting someone ask you. And thank you so much for creating this love letter to Provincetown, a place so many of us love, cherish, and want to preserve. If you are new to this show, you just heard the host. Now go and find the guests. 50 episodes, all of them worth your time. You can find the Art Colony anywhere you get your podcasts. Follow on Instagram at the Art Colony Podcast. And if you want to support the show, as we heard earlier, buymeacoffee.com. Search for the Art Colony Podcast and leave a tip. Thank you to all our listeners and viewers. Have a great day.
Thank you.